Good afternoon. Welcome to today's program, U.S.-Cuba Relations with Ambassador Carlos Alzugaray. I'm Christina Namath, Travel Director at the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about our programs, membership, and traveling with the club, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure to introduce our moderator for today's program. Professor Lisa Garcia Bedoya is Associate Professor of Social and Cultural Studies in the Graduate School of Education at the University of California, Berkeley, and Chair of Berkeley's Center for Latino Policy Research. She received her PhD in Political Science from Yale University and her BA in Latin American Studies and Comparative Literature from UC Berkeley. She's the author of Fluid Borders, Latino Power, Identity, and Politics in Los Angeles, and also Latino Politics. She is co-author with Melissa R. Michelson of Mobilizing Inclusion, Transforming the Electorate Through Get Out the Vote Campaigns. Professor Garcia Bedoya's research focuses on how marginalization and inequality structure the political opportunities available to members of ethno-racial groups, with a particular emphasis on the intersections of race, class, and gender. She is also on the steering committee of the UC Cuba Academic Initiative and has an ongoing interest in U.S.-Cuba relations, both professionally and also personally, as a Cuban American whose parents left the island in 1961. Please join me in welcoming Professor Lisa Garcia Bedoya.
Thank you, Christina, for that kind introduction and for having me here today. And thank you to all of you for coming here. I was just telling Carlos that you are a reflection of his popularity because you're here at lunchtime on a gorgeous day in San Francisco without food and are going to sit here for the next hour listening to him. So it's wonderful that you could be here to talk about an issue that those of us who care about Cuba hope moves a little higher on the radar of the Obama administration in the next, during this term. So Ambassador Carlos Alzugaray Trejo holds a PhD in history from the University of Havana. His main area of expertise is in the history and theory of international relations, though he has written many essays on political science as well. So we share that interest. Ambassador Alzugaray served in the Cuban Foreign Service from 1961 to 1996, with his last diplomatic post as ambassador head of mission to the European Union. He also served as advisor on global political affairs to foreign ministers Ricardo Alarcón and Roberto Roaina. Following his diplomatic career, he continued with a rich academic career. He was a professor and researcher at the Higher Institute for International Relations and at the Center for Hemispheric and United States Studies at Havana University. He then became the vice rector and then the department head and coordinator of strategic studies at the Higher Institute of International Relations. He has written 4 books, more than 75 academic essays, and has received several awards for his writing and teaching. He has been a visiting professor or scholar at universities in Spain, Canada, the United States, Italy, and Mexico. He has served on the executive committee of the ALACIP, the Latin American Association of Political Science, and as a member of the Cuban Academy of Sciences. Presently, he's on the executive committee of the Cuba section within the Latin American Studies Association, or LASA, and is a member of the Cuban Writers Association. Currently, he's the book review editor at Temas, a Cuban social science and humanities journal. And I think he's one of the people that's really working to build relations between Cuba and the United States and the globe. And so it's a great honor to have him here today. And please join me in giving a warm welcome to Ambassador Carlos Alzugaray Trejo.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you. Well, what to say? I'm very happy to be here. As Christina knows, I was supposed to be here last year. But, you know, the problems in the relationship between Cuba and the United States are such that sometimes we get visas, sometimes we don't. This time, I got the visa. I was able to participate in the Latin American Studies Association Congress in Washington. I was a little while in New York, where I have a daughter and 2 sons. And this is the kind of situation that we have between Cuba and the United States. No diplomatic relations, but a lot of people-to-people relations, as it should be. My cousin Jorge is here. I haven't seen him for many, many years. And this gives me really a great pleasure. And by the way, Lisa, I will tell Robertico, who now runs a very successful paladar or private restaurant called Chaplin in Havana. So, and maybe we can have dinner with him or lunch with him when you come to Havana the next time. I think that would be very interesting. Okay. Well, I have been asked to speak about Cuban U.S. relations, and well, inevitably one has to make a little bit of history. But I think there are two things that have to be said right off the bat. One, that we are too close, that we are very close neighbors, and that good fences make good neighbors, but it's unavoidable that we have common interests and at times some clashing interests. The other thing is the asymmetry, and this is a factor that I think is very important in the relationship. We are like too close, but at the same time, the United States is 30 times bigger than Cuba, but it has always had an interest in Cuba. This is the other important factor, I think, that has to be taken into account when American leaders started to think about Cuba in the early years of the Republic. Thomas Jefferson, for example, said to James Madison, Cuba is the most important acquisition we can make. And then John Quincy Adams made his famous political definition of what was going to be the relationship when he formulated the so-called ripe fruit doctrine. He said there are laws of political gravitation that are as strong as laws of physical gravitation. And just as a fruit, when it ripens, falls to the ground, so inevitably, once Cuba separates from the Spanish tree, will fall into the hands of the United States. The problem with that was that by the time that the fruit was ripe, from the U.S. perspective, and I won't go very much into that, Cubans wanted independence. What Cubans wanted was not joining the United States. There has been always a Cuban strand of thought that says we have to be part of the United States or we have to be very close to the United States. That has to be recognized. Even though some of us think that we have to be independent of the United States, but I think we must recognize the reality that we are close, that we cannot avoid having that relationship with the United States, and that nowadays there are 1,500,000 Cubans or more in the United States, and they are part of the Cuban nation. They're not different from the Cuban nation. And this is something that we have to deal with. It's a difficult problem. It's not easy for us, but it's happening. Now, it's inevitable that I mention that the United States almost took over Cuba in 1902. After intervening in the Cuban War of Independence, and in that war that usually in U.S. textbooks is called the Spanish-American War. In Cuba, you don't call it the Spanish-American War. You call it the Spanish-Cuban-American War because we started the fight. We started to fight. And the Americans participated, and I think we must be thankful. But at the same time, it must be recognized that at the end of that period, we didn't have full independence, and we had something called the Platt Amendment. The Platt Amendment was a big mistake because it imposed on Cuba a certain American protectorate. I don't want to go very much into that history. There is a very interesting book I was reading these days that I learned about in my stay here now. It's called Gangsterismo by Jack Colhoun. It's a book about the relationship between the American Mafia, Lucky Luciano, Mayor Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, with Cuban politicians before the revolution. And if you want to have an idea of how we look at it, I remember in 1958, maybe Jorge did something like I did too. I got, even though I was underage, I got once into the Havana Riviera Casino. And I look at that and I said, oh my God, what's happening here? This is gambling, prostitution, drugs, and most of all political corruption. And then at the same time, and I was telling Lisa and Cristina that when I was at Belen, at the Jesuit school in Belen, I was asked to go to catechize children in the La Lisa neighborhood in Havana. I was dumbfounded when I arrived at La Lisa and found so much poverty and so much So we had that contrast, the contrast of the United States playground and at the same time part of the country very backward, very left behind. And that made the revolution inevitable. I always say the Cuban Revolution was both necessary and inevitable. It was necessary because things had to change. And Batista made it inevitable. Fulgencio Batista Saldívar, the guy who the American ambassador used to play two times a week canasta with him, who was a bloody dictatorship, he made the Cuban Revolution inevitable. And this is what led us to the revolution and led us to the U.S. reaction to that revolution, not understanding what was happening, and the Cold War context that led to this relentless hostility that even today is very difficult to explain. Why does the United States doesn't normalize relations with Cuba when it has normal relations with China, which is a very similar country, or with Vietnam, where the United States had to fight a war and thousands of Americans lost their lives in Vietnam? What has Cuba done to the United States that is so bad, that is so terrible, that they don't come to terms with that? Now, what I'll try to do now is talk about the different, I divide this subject in four different dimensions. The diplomatic dimension, the security dimension, the economic dimension, and the societal dimension. Let me start with the diplomatic dimension. Where do we stand in the diplomatic dimension? Well, the first fact is that the United States broke diplomatic relations with Cuba in January 3, 1961, and we don't have diplomatic relations since then. Interest sections were established in 1977 as an initiative of the Carter administration. But the intention behind the establishment of the interest sections, which was eventually to lead towards normalization, was set back by the victory of the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration came in deciding that they would have to roll back any advance that had been made in the relation between Cuba and the United States. And it's very interesting. There is another good book that I recommend. It's a book by Lars Schultz, professor of history at the University of North Carolina. He has written an excellent, it's a very thick book. It's a big book to read. But it's called, it has the as title, a phrase from Teddy Roosevelt. It's called That Infernal Little Cuban Republic. The idea, Lars argues it very well, but what I want to quote from Lars is, at the first meeting of the cabinet in 1980, Alexander Haig, who, well, everybody knows that he would take into himself responsibilities that he didn't really have, he said, Mr. President, just give me the order and I'll turn Cuba into a parking lot. So imagine how that administration behaved towards Cuba. That administration basically took a very hostile attitude towards Cuba. And that led, with time, because of the context of the end of the Soviet Union, to something called the Baker Memorandum. In 1988, Cuba and the United States were involved in a very high-stake diplomatic negotiation to put an end to the war in Southwest Africa, where Cuban troops had been fighting the South African army, which had been trying to impose itself in Angola. And that negotiation was successful. I don't know, maybe some of you remember. I remember that because it was incredible. The final agreement was signed at the United Nations Security Council meeting room. George Shultz, then Secretary of State of Ronald Reagan, was presiding, and you had this bunch of Cuban generals sitting there, many of them who had been young guerrillas, but then had been the leaders of Cuba's support for Angola during the Angolan War. And a treaty was signed. And that, in a certain sense, gave the idea that we might, at the end, have a normal relationship with the United States. But then came James Baker, George Bush, George W. H. Bush, Secretary of State, and said, no, we cannot have normal diplomatic relations with Cuba. And since then, the American government maintains the position that they don't want to have a normal relationship with Cuba because they don't want to recognize the legitimacy of the Cuban government, something that is really very contradictory. It's a policy of isolation because the rest of the world has normal diplomatic relations with Cuba. Cuba has just been elected chairman of the Latin American and Caribbean States community. And that means that the legitimacy of Cuba, nobody questions the legitimacy of the Cuban government. They might not like it. The Canadians, the Spaniards don't like the Cuban government. They want to see something different in Cuba, but they respect the Cuban government because they respect things that are done by the Cuban government. Last year, for example, I was invited by the Australian government to do some political consultation because the Australian government wanted to help the Cuban government and the Pacific Island governments establish a program by which young people from the Pacific go to study medicine in Cuba. Cuba offers them scholarship, but there was a very expensive part to that, which was the plane trip. So Australia is paying for the plane trips and 200 young people from the Pacific Islands are studying medicine in Cuba, and 35 health workers of Cuba are working in the Pacific. So can we do that with the United States? There was a moment where it seemed that we would do something like that in Haiti. We were discussing, but there was a problem. The problem that Cuba was ready to participate in a joint program of aid to Haiti after the earthquake, but as happens often in the United States, there is a special regulation in the United States that facilitates Cuban doctors to have licenses when they enter the United States. This program was created in Miami and designed to facilitate the defection of Cuban doctors wherever they were. And of course, for the Cuban government, it was difficult to accept that they would cooperate with the United States when that thing was still in the books. Now, we almost broke all ties with George Bush when he sent a guy named James Kaysen to Havana. Kaysen became, and now we know, because the National Security Archives have obtained the documents, that it was all a conspiracy between him and Assistant Secretary of State Roger Noriega to create a situation in which would bring to a break the relation between Cuba and the United States. And that was in 2003 when the United States had just invaded Iraq. And many people in Miami were saying, Cuba next. So that's a problem because that has to do also with the security issue of Cuba. The other thing that I want to point out is that with Obama, we are doing better, but we are not doing enough. Obama promised a new beginning with Cuba. He has changed things, but we still have the problem that the Obama administration doesn't want to accept the legitimacy of the Cuban government and negotiate issues with the Cuban government. The Cuban government says they are ready to talk, but the United States always finds a pretext not to talk to the Cuban government. It was Alan Gross, for example, right now is the case of Alan Gross, the American who was arrested in Cuba. He was breaking the law. He was hired by a company that had subcontracted money from USAID designed to destabilize Cuba and bring about the change in the Cuban government. So he was breaking the law. He was a foreign agent inside Cuba doing things that the law doesn't allow. Yet the United States doesn't want to talk about it, and Cuba is ready to talk about it because Cuba is also interested in the case of the five Cubans who had been sent to the United States not exactly as spies. They were agents of the Cuban government, obviously, but they were sent as anti-terrorist agents. They were sent here not to overthrow the American government, but to find out what were the terrorists that were working out of Miami, and Cuba had enough evidence, and there is enough evidence that there were terrorist acts taking place in Cuba in 1997, which originated in people who are now in Miami free. I don't want to mention the guy, Luis Posada Carriles, inevitably I would. He's the Latin American Bin Laden. Now, This is the situation we have in diplomatic relations. What is the situation is in the security dimension? It must be recognized that we come from a past that is very complex. Bay of Pigs, missile crisis, terrorist acts, a Cuban response that was, okay, I am going to do to you exactly what you are doing to me. So Cuba sent military aid to revolutionaries all over the world. The famous phrase by Che Guevara, create 2-3 Vietnams. That was part of the response. And of course, that led to a very tense situation. That situation was very tense in the 70s and the 80s. But is it tense now? Obviously not. That situation doesn't exist from both sides. There is even limited cooperation on many security issues, drug trafficking, immigration. The only agreement between Cuba and the United States that is enforced is an immigration agreement. You download the annual report of the State Department about drug trafficking, and you would be surprised how well they speak about Cuba, how well the cooperation is going on that. So there are a number of areas of cooperation. Hurricanes is one. Hurricanes is vital for us. Last year, Sandy hit Cuba and then hit the United States. And you probably is better that you know that whenever there is a hurricane, the Miami Center for Hurricane Control and the Cuban Meteorological Institute immediately start to cooperate very strongly. So strongly that American anti-hurricane planes fly over Cuba during the passage of hurricanes over Cuba, and that there is this intimate connection on this issue. And there is a security regime in Guantanamo. Of course, in the end, probably the best thing would happen is that the prison camp is closed in Guantanamo, as President Obama wants to do, and that the territory of the base be returned to Cuba. What can we do with Guantanamo? Well, Cuba has a proposal. Let's turn Guantanamo turn Guantanamo into a research center for tropical disease and jointly manned by Cuba and the United States under the Pan American Health Organization purview. That would be a great idea. Terrorism, obviously, is the elephant in the room because the United States still has Cuba in the list of states that sponsor terrorism. There is not a shred of evidence that Cuba is involved in any of that, but yet it's still kept. Not only that, Cuba is accused of having relations with the FARC of Colombia, with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, but what is happening in reality is that the Cuban government has been asked by the Colombian government to help negotiate a deal between the FARC and the Colombian government, and that already started. Last week in Havana, the Colombian government and the FARC announced that they had reached the first part of an agreement. So on security issues, there is a paradoxical situation. We have a lot of cooperation. Even though that's a very difficult problem, and that would mean, I mean, in any other consideration, security issues would be the big issue. Well, they are not. So that reinforces the idea that we should have better relations. What to say about the economic dimension that you don't know? The embargo, we call it the blockade. I always say, I am ready to compromise. Illegal unilateral economic sanctions. And they are illegal because the United Nations every year says that it's illegal. And the United Nations every year, by huge votes, tells the United States, stop the embargo on Cuba, change that. It was established by Kennedy in 1962. Again, the Cold War. It's enshrined in the law by the Torricelli and Hans-Porton Act. And to boot, putting Cuba in the terrorism list adds new sanctions to the sanctions that exist because of the embargo. For example, the Treasury Department persecutes any kind of operation that any European bank does with Cuba and has fined European banks for dealing with Cuba. And this creates, of course, a big problem for Cuba because it's very difficult for Cuba to obtain credit in fair terms. Usually the credit to Cuba costs more because of that. Let me talk now about the societal linkages. Societal linkages are very important. There is a tradition, a necessity, and a positive influence that our societies interconnect. And that usually takes place in the academic sphere, in the educational sphere, in the cultural sphere, and the scientific sphere, that we have so much to learn from each other. And this goes way back, probably, to the 19th century. The first baseball bat and the first baseball were brought to Cuba by two kids who were sent by their parents to study in Mobile, Alabama. And that's how baseball started to be part of our interrelationship. And it will be in the future. There was a news today that Cuba came back to the Caribbean Professional Baseball Federation and that Cuba will play again in this series of the Caribbean, which was one of the big baseball professional baseball championships that Cuba used to participate. But one of the issues that really hurts us is the restriction on travel to Cuba. The restriction of travel to Cuba cannot possibly have any explanation. Because Americans have a right to travel to Cuba, and Cuba is the only country which they are prohibited from traveling. Secondly, because it would be very good for Cubans to learn more about the United States. I've been pushing for that. I've been pushing for Cubans to come and Americans to go. Recently, I think the day before yesterday, the New York Times interviewed, there's a blog in the digital edition of the New York Times, interviewing one of Cuba's most important bloggers, a girl, 28 years old, not Joanny Sanchez, Elaine Diaz. She's a professor of digital journalism at the University of Havana. And she's one of these Cubans that needs to have a better contact with the United States. We finally got her. Initially, they refused the visa to her because she was considered a potential immigrant. But they finally gave it to the visa. She came to Lhasa. She went to New York. She's now in Miami. She's learning about the United States because this is very important, that we learn from the United States so that our young people have a view of the diversity and the richness of this country, which I think the embargo is one of the problems that creates the difficulty for that. The people-to-people exchanges and the so-called purposeful travel have to be understood as something to bring us closer together and not as an instrument of subversion. Finally, I think that on this issue of societal linkages, a very important role can be played by the Cuban American community. And that is changing. That is changing. We see groups like, for example, the Cuba Study Group changing their position on Cuba and saying, let's normalize relations with Cuba. Let's lift, let's abrogate, let's eliminate Helms-Burton and Torricelli so that we can have a better and more normal relationship with Cuba. I sincerely believe that that's going to happen. Let me give some final remarks. First, the first conclusion, we have never had normal relations. So we have to construct a new normal relationship. The present relationship is more a Cold War thing, and the Cold War is over. I remember last year, during the Republican fight for the nomination, there was this debate in Miami between Newt Gingrich, Mitt Romney, Rick Santorum, and Ron Paul. And I think Ron Paul hit it. He said, guys, the Cold War is over. Let's normalize relations with Cuba. And it was in Tampa, and he was applauded, even though usually in these debates the moderator requests that no applause be taken. There is a long history of mistrust that we have to overcome. We cannot continue accept that Cubans and Americans look at each other with stereotypes. We are much more diverse and much more different. And that's something that is happening in Cuba again and again and again. I am very happy to be part of a project, the journal Temas, which has constant political debates. We pride ourselves in being very open to public debate. You can visit our website. We have accounts in Facebook. Temas has an account for the journal and has an account for Último Jueves. That is the last Thursday of every month. We organize a public debate on a public issue in a public space. The last debate, last Thursday, two Thursdays ago, was about public opinion and decision making. We have had debates about internet. We have had debates about the double currency, most of the issues that worry Cubans. We have to abandon, again, that roller coaster. I mean, with Obama, we have been advancing, and hopefully we will advance more. My hope is that under Obama, Cuba is taken out of the terrorism list and the expansion of travel continues. I think that would be a very incredible. If we can also get a negotiation between the two governments to get Alan Gross to return to the United States and the four to return to Cuba, which I think won't hurt anyone, that these people reunite with their families, that would be great. The image of the U.S. government in Cuba is the image of that the United States government won't give up trying to change Cuba. But Cuba is changing with the help or with the intervention, without the intervention of the United States. The changes in Cuba, I think, open the way for better relationship. I hope that there are also changes in the United States that bring better relationship between our two countries. Thank you very much.
I'd like to remind all our listeners that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Ambassador Carlos Azuaray Trejo, who is discussing relations between the U.S. and Cuba. We're now going to enter the question period, and I have quite a stack of cards, which I'm hoping we can get through at least a good portion of them, and one more. But I'm going to give a familial privilege. There is a question from your primo chino, as he describes himself, asking whether Cuba will accept more political parties that will question the one-party rules. And he also wants you to say hello to his tía and la prima Lourdes, and wants to know if you have time for lunch. Y que viva Cuba.
Thank you, Chino. I think the issue of more political parties, it has been put on the table. Recently, the journal Espacio Laical, one of the journals with which I cooperate, brought out a document called Casa Cuba, in which they formulated it in a rather different way. They said the government, they are calling for a constitutional reform that would open the way for Cubans to associate themselves freely and have that possibility. I agree with that. I don't have any problem with that idea. But I don't know if we are ready yet for this idea of more political parties. You remember we had a history in which political parties were very corrupt and very ineffective. And you know that because your uncle, my father, was a member of the Partido Ortodoxo, a high member of the Partido Ortodoxo. And unfortunately, the political system was incapable of stopping something like what happened with Batista. So we have to think about that. I don't know if that... I know that we need more democracy and more autonomy for all the members. And I don't think Raul Castro would disagree with that. But we have to work this thing in a way that it doesn't, that it's not destabilizing. So, I don't know. Things might happen. Recently, the historian of Havana, Eusebio Leal, announced that the parliament will return to El Capitolio Nacional and that there would be a Senate. Well, maybe that happens. Maybe there will be an Alzugaray senator sometime in the future. Yes.
Eddie Chivas killed himself while he was in a radio program. But he was condemning the government. He was asking questions. What would Eddie Chivas think about this situation now?
That's a good question, Chino, but I don't think I have an easy answer for that. But let me give you the example of the example I talked about today, Elaine Diaz. This girl, this 28-year-old girl, you can read the blog in the New York Times. Elaine made herself famous. She's part of this movement of Cuban bloggers. And she made herself famous for denouncing something similar that of Chivas, but at a smaller scale. She denounced her first blog when she started blogging. she denounced that a director of a high school was selling the passes, you know, one of these boarding schools that existed in the countryside. He was making money out of selling the passes for the kids to go home over the weekend. Usually the kids would go home on Saturday morning. He was telling the kids, if you pay me, I will send you on Friday. And she wrote the block. Initially, she had trouble, but finally, the Ministry of Education accepted that, made an investigation, expelled the guy, and then the guy was tried and convicted of corruption. So things like what you like to happen are happening in Cuba. But still, we have to work on that.
Not surprisingly, we have a lot of questions around the issue of normalization, and some of them are sort of point of information questions. So I thought I'd start with those and then work into the other issues that were raised. And one of them was the role of the European Union in either supporting or undermining the embargo. And at least this person suggests that Europe doesn't trade with Cuba. My understanding is that actually they do, and that that's part of. So I'm going to adjust this question a little to say, what can Europe do to help facilitate that process? Is there any type of pressure that has been placed on the United States, or does the fact that Europe and Canada and other countries have those trade relationships change the situation in any way?
The European Union is a very complex political institution. I think it was Jacques Delors who said once, it's an unidentified political object. And its process of taking foreign policy decisions is extremely complicated because it requires the voting of all the members. Now, they have grown from 15. When I was ambassador to the European Union, there were 15 countries. So it was rather easy to work with them. Now they are 28. And that's very complicated. Some of the new members are the old socialist countries. And what happens is that the European Union is of two minds about Cuba. One mind of the European Union wants to bring European Union policy closer to American policy. That was something that was partly achieved by the Aznar government in 1996 when they were able to get the European Union to adopt the common position. The common position of the European Union says that they will continue to have normal relations with Cuba, but that they would subordinate any advance in the relationship to and the signing of a cooperation agreement to the changes that Cuba brings, especially on political reform. Cuba, off the bat, rejected that, said that's an unacceptable intervention in Cuban internal affairs. And since then, we have had this problem. The on the one side, one part of the European Union saying, yes, let's advance in our relation with Cuba. Other part of the European Union saying, no, we cannot advance until Cuba changes. Even in some cases, like Spain, that has depended on the government that has been in power. When the Partido Popular has been in power, they adopt the hardline position. When the Partido Socialista had been in power, they adopt the softer line position. So it's kind of complicated, but a very interesting development happened this year, and it is in the website of my journal, Tebas. Let me propagandize a little bit. The new director of the Americas of the Service for Foreign Action of the European Union visited Cuba and started talks with Cuba, and the Cuban side accepted it. The Cuban side accepted it. The view right now is that we should go to a cooperation agreement and talk about a cooperation agreement and avoid any talk of the common position. The Cuban position was until the European Union repeals the common position, we don't talk to you. But the Cuban government is saying now, we are ready to talk. And the European Union is saying, we are ready to go for a cooperation agreement. Would that work? It depends. It's difficult. Diplomats are there to solve these difficult problems. But I think it's interesting what's happening because with the European Union, the relationship is very similar to the relationship with the United States in certain sense, but in other sense, no, because the European Union doesn't apply economic sanctions on Cuba, although, of course, it's difficult for Cuba to penetrate the European market because they have this very, I mean, they wouldn't like me to say it, but they are actually protectionists. So, for example, Cuba lost the sugar market in Europe. The European Union became a net exporter of sugar when Cuba used to export sugar to the European Union. So it's difficult to solve that. But there is a lot of goodwill going on between the two sides, which I think will help eventually for us to have a normal relationship with the European Union. I always like, by the way, the Canadian example. Canada is as close ally of the United States as the European Union. Canada has an excellent relationship with Cuba, the number one partner in tourism, the number two partner in investment, and the number four partner in trade.
So given the current realities, what timeline scenario can you envision for normalization of U.S.-Cuba relations, particularly on the economic side? And specifically, we have another person that asks, will there be any protections for Cuban industry if that change were to happen, given the potential destabilizing force it would have on Cuban companies? Could you imagine first when you think it might happen, and how would you protect what's there?
It's extremely difficult to envisage how would that work. I am of the opinion that what will probably happen is a gradual process of elimination of all the limitations that exist. And yes, of course, the protection of Cuban industry is a big point. But of course, Cuban industry first has to be safe from a number of factors, but one of them, very important, which is in the hands of the Cuban government to solve, is safe from the Cuban government's policies, which have not been precisely very good for Cuban industry. But this is a problem that is being addressed. Every 2 weeks, you will have an information about the Council of Ministers meeting and adopting new reforms in order to create more opportunities for Cubans not only to work effectively, but to make a good salary. There are examples in Cuba which are good to follow. The pharmaceutical industry, for example, is very good. It has been very effective, has developed new products, and they are we're something that is very little known. We are producing Cuban patented pharmaceuticals in China in investment jointly with China, but the factories are in China, not in Cuba.
So speaking of different sorts of reforms, there was a question about asking you to explain how private property is currently being sold in Cuba and Havana. And first, how does it become private, or how is it decided that it is privately held? And then do you have agents? Is it run by the government? So how does that process work?
I think the first thing that is important to realize is that the Raul Castro government has made it plain that private enterprises are part of the model. And this is a big political change from the tendency in the past, which was this is un mal necesario, a necessary evil. We have to accept. No, the government is of the mind and is pushing for the idea that private enterprise and private initiative are part of the system and that they have all the rights. For example, one important thing is that all the people who work in the private sector have social security, which didn't exist in the past. So these are very important and interesting developments. Still, I don't think the Cuban government has reached the point to define very well where does that end and where does that begin, in the sense that for the time being, what the Cuban government has deregulated and permitted to exist are small businesses, basically the paladares, the restaurants, and some other businesses, but not businesses where Cubans who have a university degree can work on what they study, which is the point. I mean, you can find a person with a university degree working in a restaurant, but that's not what you would like. I mean, you, after all, you invested in preparing that person, so that person should be more effective. The government hasn't reached that point yet, but it's going to. I am fairly confident that that point is going to be reached. The other definition that has to be done is about property. What kind of is the government really to allow small and medium-sized enterprises. I think these are things that are on the table. They are not rejected, but still there's a long way to go on that issue. But again, the government is calculating that by 2015, 45% of the jobs will be in the non-state or private sector, which I think is important.
Right. So we have literally five questions asking about the Cuban American community and the role that you believe that they might play. Both, most of these assume that they will play an oppositional role to normalized relations, but as a Cuban American, I have to throw out the possibility that the Cuban American community could actually play a facilitative role in that process. So how do you imagine, what role do you think the Cuban American community is going to play if we move towards normalization with Cuba?
I think two things are happening. One, more and more Cuban Americans are coming to the conclusion that they would like the blockade lifted and the embargo lifted and a more normal relation with Cuba. I think that means that they have abandoned what I think is unacceptable, the idea that they can influence what's happening in Cuba through sanctions or coercion from the American government, which is the basic idea behind the embargo. But at the same time, that's changing. Obviously, that's changing. Unfortunately, the sociological change is there, but then the political change. The political change still, the people you see representing the Cuban American community or the faces mm-hmm. of the Cuban American community in the United States are Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Bob Menendez, Ileana Ros Lehtinen, Lincoln Diaz-Valar. On the other hand, you have now a Joe Garcia, which is a different kind of...
And Menendez?
Menendez has a hard line on Cuba. He's a liberal, but a hard line on Cuba. So I think maybe in the future, people like that will not be the face, the political face of the Cuban American community. There would be another face, a more, let's say, more forthcoming face with Cuba. But the other change is taking place on the other side. On the other side, I think there was a time where I wouldn't talk to Chino. But now I can talk to Chino very well. I think we have changed in Cuba. Now, there are still people who haven't changed, who still think that any Cuban American who left is a traitor and should be dealt with that way. But more and more Cuban Americans are not thinking that, or Cubans are not thinking that way. And this, for example, this is a debate that takes place on the issue of culture. We were talking about that, Lisa. Mm-hmm. There was a time when you would ask a Cuban intellectual, or not a Cuban intellectual, someone who had to deal with cultural policy in Cuba, and you would ask him, is Gloria Estefan part of Cuban culture? They would go up in flames. No. Now it's normal. Now you can hear Gloria Estefan, or you can hear, what's the name of this guy?
Which one?
The one who had the song that is called
Pitbull?
Que Viene Llegando. It's a very famous. Willie
Chirino. Willie Chirino.
So now you can hear.
I was thinking Pitbull.
Or Celia Cruz. You
can also
hear
quite
them.
Conservative.
You can hear them in Cuban. Well, not in the radio, but you can hear it in any party and any... So mm-hmm. people are coming to terms with that reality. And there's a reality. Many of the people who are going to leave Cuba after 2018 are going to be people who part of their high school class is in the United States and part is in Cuba. And they have this relation. I always call that... there's a famous school in Cuba, the Vladimir Ilyich Lenin Vocational School. It's very famous because it's an elite school. The people who study there are usually very good students. So there's a website called lalenin.com. Go to lalenin.com and you will see some of them who have stayed in Cuba who are now ministers, ambassadors, interconnecting with people who are outside Cuba. So even that, social networking, will become part of the future of Cuba. So I think that eventually we will have a more normal relationship with the outside world. And of course, the other thing that is happening is that many Cuban Americans are investing in Cuba. Not openly, but they're sending money to their relatives so that they can establish a paladar or something. So that's another connection there that that it's going to develop. And the government is not persecuting that or reacting against that. That's happening.
Just as a point of information for people in the audience who don't know that Raul Castro made the historic announcement that he's going to be stepping down in 2018. So related to this point, so for the first time since the revolution, you will not have a Castro as the head of government in Cuba. There is an heir apparent, but we were talking earlier about the other, you know, you've just referenced this new generation. Can you talk a bit more about what that new generation looks like? Mm-hmm. Who are the players and what you think they bring to the debate?
Let me expand on what you said. Not only he has said he's stepping down, he proposed, and the Congress of the Communist Party accepted, term limits.
Right. And age limits, which I found very interesting.
That has not been put in writing.
Well, at least, the fact that it was proposed, given were just talking about the octogenarians that have been running the...
Yes, well, I got that question yesterday at a lecture I gave at Stanford University. I think what is interesting is that a man like Raul Castro is saying that. He demonstrates a pragmatism and a vision that I think is very important for the future of Cuba, because he's the kind of person who can guarantee that process takes place. I was telling Lisa that it's like two generations have been sidestepped in this process. There is this 80s, late 70s, early 80s generation. They're still around. And there, for example, my generation, you find very few of my generation in the government. As a matter of fact, for example, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is trying to push. They are not applying absolutely, but there is now a ruling that you cannot be an ambassador after 65, which I find that, I mean, you maybe cannot have a colonel after 65, because that's physical job. But an ambassador, the more experience they have, the better. That's an experimented ambassador talking.
But don't they get too honest as they get older? That may be the problem.
I don't know. Nobody can predict what happens. But I think the new generation, I exemplify the new generations of leaders in Cuba with Miguel Díaz-Canel, the so-called heir apparent. This guy is 52, 53 years old. He has a diploma in engineering, but he's a very good politician. Let me tell you something that happened when he was elected first secretary of the Communist Party in the province of Villa Clara. And he arrived in Santa Clara. That's a city in central Cuba, a very important city. So important they are in the playoffs. Villa Clara is playing the playoffs against Matanzas. The Industriales, which is the Yankees. The Cuban Yankees are not in the playoffs. He arrived in Santa Clara when there was a looming conflict between the gay community in Santa Clara, which had, in a declaration of autonomy, rarely seen in Cuba at the time, I'm talking about the late 80s, early 90s, they had created a gay community center called El Mejunje. El Mejunje is a mix, right? Translated into Spanish. And some of the old party people in Santa Clara were mad about it. They were saying, how can we permit this? We have to close them down, et cetera, et cetera. So when Díaz-Canel arrived, this is a story, and this story is very well known in Cuba. When Díaz-Canel arrived, the party, the members of the party leadership in Santa Clara told him, you have to close down. Your first measure should be to close down this place. And he said, sorry, not only I am not going to close them down, I am going to visit them tomorrow and learn how can I support their process. So this is the kind of guy that we're apparently getting as the heir apparent. The other interesting thing he did was create a radio show, a radio talk show, early morning, 7 o'clock, to talk with the people. So people could call at the radio station. He would spend about half an hour there. The other thing that happened is something that the correspondent of BBC recently wrote in one of his blogs. When he arrived in Santa Clara at that time, he told a guy, listen, I want to interview the first secretary of the Communist Party in Santa Clara. And his friend told him, oh, no problem. You see that young man in T-shirt and shorts lining up to buy a pizza? that's him. So the guy really is a very regular guy, a guy who is open to new ideas, well prepared, as most of the people who are in their late 40s, early 50s in Cuba, they have a university degree and they have lived. My main concern is that they are people who have been born and raised in a country with absolutely no relationship with the United States, not because it is the United States, but because it is our most important close neighbor. And we have to know the United States. We have to know it not because I tell you or indoctrinate you about the United States. You have to know about the United States. What is really the United States?
So given that, do you think that will affect, because theoretically he would be overseeing a transition? Do you think, well, we never talked about a firm timeline, but do you think normalization will happen in the next 5 years? And if not, then the generation that will be overseeing normalization is a generation that actually has very little experience in the United States. Do you think that would be an issue?
I think we must, well, I don't know. It's the U.S. political process is also a very complicated political process. And I am not American. I am not. I try to explain the United States to my students in Cuba. It's very funny because when I come to the United States, I talk about Cuba. But in Cuba, I talk about the United States. I was the other day, they invited me to one of the main television programs in Cuba to talk about Obama and the issue of gun control, et cetera, et cetera. And it was very funny because at the end I had to say something that very few people say in Cuban television, and maybe not even in American television. Let's give Obama the benefit of the doubt. And of course, I know that many people don't want to give Obama any more the benefit of the doubt, but that's another subject. I will get into that. But it's important that we can deal with the problem of eliminating the many veils of distrust that exist about what are the U.S. intentions in Cuba, what really is going to happen in Cuba. So, because it can be interpreted that if the United States tomorrow takes a step of lifting the embargo, it might be interpreted that it's a change of methods, but not a change of purposes. And that the purpose would continue to be a regime change. So, but anyway, I don't think the ideal would be that we reach the end of the Obama administration with Cuba out of the terrorism list, Americans freely traveling to Cuba, and the beginning of a thaw in the embargo, mm-hmm. Which I think is going to be very difficult. In my view, what's going to happen is that once we reach a certain point, it would simply explode. It would simply, I mean, I don't think, for example, that if Americans are allowed to go to Cuba, I mean, that business can be a 5 million person business or 3 million person business. That's huge. Will American companies want to take part in that? Of course, the American hotel companies, American airplane manufacturing companies. Right now we have a situation. We cannot buy any airplane in the world. We cannot buy Americans because of the blockade. But we cannot buy Airbus, the European planes, because they have more than 10% American components. And the embargo law established that nobody can sell Cuba any product that has more than 10%. So we were buying Russian planes. And the Russians recently told us that they are bringing more American components into their planes. So eventually we will have that problem. So there are many, you know, we have to run a lot of things. We have to do a lot of things. And I am a gradualist. I don't think that it should be a big bang thing. It should be more. So 4 or 5 years, if under Obama we get Cuba out of the terrorism list, the travel ban lifted, then we can think that under the next administration, if it is not Republican, we could imagine Marco Rubio. What would be Marco Rubio's policy on Cuba?
It's a little frightening to imagine. I'm going to, as moderator, take the liberty of asking the last question, because it is, the irony, though, is that, in fact, it hasn't changed much between Democratic and Republican administrations in terms of U.S. policy. It's changed along the margins over the course of the last 50 years. So my question is, I've been part of groups of academics who've written letters and who've done things, but generally speaking, under Obama, as you know, Latin America in general and Cuba specifically has not been a very high priority. And granted, he has other priorities this week that were not of his choosing. But what do you imagine people in the Cuban American community and other individuals who are supportive of movement toward what you're talking about, at least by the end of the Obama administration, what do you imagine we can do? Or what are the things that you think, what kinds of cooperative agreements, relationships? I hadn't realized, thinking about Facebook, social media, it seems like there are opportunities, technology gives us opportunities to connect human to human in ways that weren't possible before. How can we take advantage of that to sort of move this ball forward on both sides?
I think what is necessary is a better understanding of Cuba, a better understanding where Cuba is and where Cuba is going. I forgot to mention among the interesting things that the Cuban government is doing is building one of the largest container ports in Cuba, transshipment ports, which will bring a lot of Asian products, because that's designed to take advantage of the opening up of the Panama Canal and bringing the big new Panamax ships to Cuba. And that's going to be the port of Mariel. We all know what Mariel has meant in Cuban-American history, but Mariel is facing New Orleans. It's right there near Tampa. So I think one of the things, for example, there are things going on. For example, recently there was an agreement on oil, on cooperating. It was, both governments don't want to talk about it, but it exists. So we have to start unveiling these veils that one would be the terrorism list, get Cuba out of terrorism list. The other thing would be great if we could reach an agreement on Alan Gross and the five.
So that the four.
The four, well, yes, because Rene is in Cuba.
Yes.
We still talk about the five. And the four. That would be great, because I think that would be a great signal of the humanitarian concern of both governments towards the citizens of the other government.
Right.
So I think that would be, and of course, travel. I think the more Americans travel to Cuba, the better.
Well, I was noting to Christina earlier that there are more New York Times stories about Jay-Z and Beyonce's 3-day visit to Cuba than there were on Raul's announcement that he's stepping down in 2018, which is probably a reflection of our news coverage, but suggests the importance of travel and connection. And just to say, if Yasiel Puig can fix the Dodgers offense, which as a former Dodger fan, I can say has not been possible over the last decade, no matter how much money we paid $14 million for Kevin Brown, not to pitch. One could imagine that anything is possible in Cuban-American relations. And with that, I want to thank you for your time and your insight.
Thank you.
To Ambassador Carlos Alzugaray and Professor Lisa Garcia Bedoya. And thank you to our audience here and those listening online. And if anyone is interested in joining one of the club's journeys to Cuba in November, December, we've got information in the library. I'm here to speak with you. And I am Christina Namath. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.